We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
Go on without me. Just go!
A good soldier never leaves a man behind.
Because I wouldn't give you 2 cents for all your fancy rules if behind them they didn't have a little bit of plain, ordinary, everyday kindness.
Life, finds a way.
Welcome to Silver Screen Biases. Each week we pick a movie off of IMDb's Top 250 and dig into it. We're examining truth claims in critically acclaimed movies while also examining our own biases. I'm Nelson.
This is Jeff.
And this week,
Cool Hand Luke.
This episode is brought to you by our community on Patreon. They make this show happen, and you can help. Links to our Patreon and merchandise are in the show notes. Now back to the show.
Happy Easter, Nelson.
Happy Easter. He is risen.
He is riz for D, indeed. For I saw a lot of memes this year about like, he is riz, which I don't even know what riz means, but the cool kids are saying, but yeah.
Do you want me to break that down for you?
Nah.
I don't keep up with new slang, but this one was explained to me.
You know this one?
Yeah.
It probably just means bus. Is it the same as bussin?
I don't know what bussin means.
I don't know what bussin means.
So riz is short for charisma.
Oh. You know, Jesus was not very charismatic. Like, they say he was really? The one verse
he had no form of loveliness, right, that you should care for him.
Like, so I imagine that would mean he probably wasn't very like charismatic or like.
No, I think that means he wasn't a super handsome guy.
Right, but like, is there any definition?
At one point,
that,
he fed 5,000 people.
Right, you can feed people without being a people.
There was 5,000 people there that needed fed.
Right. What I'm saying is like. Was he very charismatic? Was he outgoing, or was he kind of reserved and kept to himself, and he only talks a bunch? I don't know. Like,
I think
he obviously interacted with a lot of people.
I think that he had a level of charisma that could only be explained as divine.
And riz, Jesus had riz.
Jesus had riz. He is risen.
He is riz indeed.
Risen indeed.
That's what I said.
All right.
Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah, but to the audience, this is not Easter. In fact, no. To the audience,
Easter's been a minute.
It's been 2 weeks, yeah. Or a week and a half-ish. Anyway, the point is that for us today, it's actually April Fool's.
Yes, it is. So we chose the funniest movie on the list to do.
That's right.
Cool Hand Luke.
Cool Hand Luke. Cool Hand Luke.
it's a Star Wars movie, right?
That's right.
Yeah, it's a Star Wars film.
This is between Empire and Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. It's a whole movie based around one interaction.
Yeah.
Was this your first dance with this movie?
Yeah, in fact, I think this might be my first Paul Newman movie. Now, at the end of the last episode, at the end of Ratatouille, we were discussing Newman's Own, and you had said that it was the same Newman, and I said, and we went back and forth, and right. Then we said we would iron this out for right. Next episode.
And so you have some ironing out.
I have the answer.
Okay,
Newman's Own is an American food company headquartered in Connecticut. Founded in 1982 by actor Paul Newman and author A.E. Hotchner, the company donates all of its after-tax profits to charity through Newman's Own Foundation, a private nonprofit foundation that supports child-focused programs.
Way to go, Paul Newman.
Yeah.
Man.
And their salad dressings are...
Yeah, that's the only dressing we use when we make coleslaw is Newman's Own coleslaw dressing.
Interesting.
Yeah, like I can picture that bottle in my house. Like, that's the only one we buy when we do coleslaw.
Well, if you want to make your own, I believe it's equal parts mayonnaise, vinegar, and sugar.
But no one should. They should get Newman's Own coleslaw dressing.
100% of profits go to child-focused charity.
Not a sponsor. Yeah, no, this is also my first time with this movie. I'd always heard the phrase. There's actually a Christian band, or I don't know if they're Christian. Let me look this up here real quick. Okay, so they are in under the Christian genre. There's a Christian band called Cool Hand Luke that was out, alternative rock, progressive. I wasn't very familiar with them either, but I was more familiar with them as a band than I was of it being a movie.
Okay.
So like, I had always heard of the phrase Cool Hand Luke, and it was growing up, it was, oh yeah, that's a band. Like,
yeah. And I'd always thought this was a Clint Eastwood movie.
Oh yeah. There's, and it's not a Western at all. Like,
no.
this isn't,
but I mean, Western is a pretty broad category. It doesn't have to be cowboys.
What movie does this, what state does this movie take place in?
Georgia.
Georgia. Well, so it's an Eastern.
It's kind of unclear.
It's an Eastern film.
It's somewhere in the South. But the set was based off of measurements taken from a Georgia State facility that did this. Mm-hmm. But I believe they filmed in Louisiana.
Okay. Did you like it?
I did. It's a slow burn.
It's
an unusual movie.
I enjoyed it too. I thought it was entertaining. I would also say the word unusual too, because like I didn't understand the premise.
Sure.
Like there wasn't, you're just watching a guy interact and live out a couple moments of time in prison. Like there's no end game. Like you see him make choices, you see him make some decisions, but like in the end, like at first I was thinking, okay, he's trying to get in. Like he was trying to get into prison for some reason. Like there's an ulterior motive. He wants to be in there. Like he's got something to do once he gets on the inside. And never once did that become a thing. Cause I was like, right. He just willingly got arrested. He looked like he wasn't trying hard at all to not get caught.
No.
Like, I was like, I was assuming there was more to his incarceration, and yeah. Nothing ever came of it. I was just like, oh, he just was just drunk, defacing parking meters, and got arrested.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, so like, I enjoyed it as a film, but at the same time, I'm like, it didn't go anywhere.
You were expecting a twist.
Right. I was expecting
there was
just
no twist.
Some deeper running story. And like, there
have
wasn't.
Have you ever read The Catcher in the Rye?
I have not. I'm familiar with it, but I've not read it.
I think these two stories are similar in that. Yes, there is a plot. Yes, there is a climax, but it's not a typical narrative structure.
Right.
Right? Like the climax of this movie is in the church.
Yes, at the very end.
The plot of the movie is a man is experiencing jail.
Prison in the 1950s.
Yeah. But that's, it's not a typical narrative structure. Like there's no, who's the antagonist?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Like,
if anything, the antagonist is maybe the jail guards.
Maybe, but they were doing their job. Like,
Nuremberg defense. Interesting, Jeff.
No, like,
just teasing.
But I mean, but they are like you expect prison guards, especially in this type of setting, to be ruthless. So, yeah. like the prison guards did not act differently than I would have expected.
Right.
Like, even the warden. The warden was very
A bit of a plantation owner. Almost.
Yeah. Like, and I got some of those vibes too. Like it very much felt, yeah. Like, so like nothing in this movie felt out of place except for the fact that I was wanting more of a story.
Also interestingly, and I don't know if this was an intentional choice or if it's a product of the era and how casting worked then, none of the prisoners are black.
Correct.
I don't know if they had segregated prisons at the time. They might've, that could plausibly make sense, but it might be like, we're going to make this only about.
There were some in the film, but yep. it was when he makes his second escape or first escape. His second escape, he comes across a black family. They help him. They provide the axe for him to break his chains.
And the cayenne pepper to disrupt the dogs.
Yes. So it definitely wasn't putting them in any sort of negative light, but their screen time was minimal.
Right. And I feel like if you introduce a black character into the jailhouse, then that's some other stories that need to be told.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been a different I feel like because of it being in the 50s and stuff.
That would have been at least a scene or two.
Correct.
Yeah.
And there would have been dialogue about it. Yeah. This movie, there was nothing in this movie, specifically in the cinematography, that I was like, oh, wow, these shots are gorgeous. Like, it felt down earth. It felt low-key. It felt sweaty and gritty and dirty, which is the vibe they were getting. But like for them to be in this, what could have been a very scenic or very camera-friendly environment,
yeah,
I don't think they chose not to take the landscape in an optimistic way.
Yeah.
It's like, so like, as a film, like with this being a pretty notable film, like I was expecting there to be these almost like Gone with the Wind type shots of like these long pauses gazing off into the, like there was none of that.
No, it felt more like Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah. Which I've never seen, like, but even, LA Confidential, we were talking about earlier, like it felt a little bit like that. Just gritty and like almost noir type moments, but this this definitely wasn't a noir type film. Mm. But
in a way it is. So one of the big aspects of noir literature is analyzing kind of like power disparities between criminals and police, motivations for crime, the seedy underbelly, overuse of violence in policing. And those are all things this movie...
Violence!
Those are all things that this movie, I think, discusses.
Yeah. So, yeah. 1967 is when this film came out. Yeah. It's approximately 2 hours and 7 minutes. Directed by Stuart Rosenberg.
What else has he directed that we might know?
I didn't recognize a single thing. Under
I
his
only
roster.
Recognize a single one.
Another one than this? Yeah. Which one?
Amityville Horror.
See, I recognize that, but I only know of that because of the most modern rendition of it. I didn't even know there was an older version of it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So like when it said Amityville Horror, I'm like, oh, so the one I know is a remake. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard of this one before.
I know of it. I've never seen it.
Okay. The rating for this film is GP, which I'm assuming stands for general public.
Probably.
But because it's a prison movie, we're going to refer to it as Gen Pop.
Yeah.
I believe general it population
for the paper company Georgia Pacific.
Georgia Pacific. That makes sense. We've not done any movies. We've not reviewed any movies from 67 or 68.
Yeah.
So this movie stands alone in a 3-year area currently of movies we've reviewed. Is this movie based on any sort of writing?
Yes, it's based on Don Pierce's 1965 novel, Cool Hand Luke.
Okay,
I want to talk about Don Pierce a little bit.
Okay.
So
you want to do it now?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Because basically Cool Hand Luke is it's not really an autobiography so much as it's inspired by his own experiences and the people he knew while in prison. So he was born in the suburbs of Philadelphia, left home at 15, and attempted to join the United States Merchant Marine at 16, but was turned away because of his age. He lied about his age, registered for the draft, and was inducted into the United States Army in 1944. He didn't like the rules that were considered unnecessary in the military, so he went AWOL. 3 days after, he thought better of it, turned himself into the Navy. His sentence was 30 days in the stockade. He served 3 days of a sentence, then was transferred to a combat infantry unit. Anticipating being sent to the front, because it was World War II, he wrote his mother a letter. Again, he ran away from home at 15. She contacted the army, informed them of his true age, and he was thrown out of the army. By this time, he was old enough to join the Merchant Marine. So the Merchant Marine took him to Venice when he was 18, to Spain, Denmark, France, Portugal, and Bombay. Post-war Europe had a thriving black market, and Pierce became involved in counterfeiting American money. He attempted to pass some counterfeit bills to a police officer in Marseille and was arrested, tried, and imprisoned in a French prison. Assigned to a work detail outside the prison grounds, Pierce escaped, making his way to the Italian border. The French officials had taken his seaman's papers, so he forged new ones and signed them onto a ship to Canada. He crossed from Canada into the United States, where he began a new career, burglary. He became a safecracker, and in 1949, at age 50, he was arrested for burglary. He served 2 years in the Florida Department of Correction chain gangs. In 1965, Scribner's published his first novel, Cool Hand Luke. And with screenwriter Frank Pearson, he went on to co-write the Academy Award-nominated screenplay for the 1967 film.
Okay.
He wrote a few other books, but mostly was a freelance journalist for Playboy and Esquire. When people, it's not really a joke here anymore, but I remember as a kid, people talking about like, oh, I just get them for the articles. The fact of the matter is, the articles that were run in those publications were actually pretty interesting.
Substantial, yeah.
It just also happened to be that nobody was buying it for the articles.
A skin magazine.
Yeah. He passed away in Fort Lauderdale, Florida at age 88 in 2017.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
So I thought that insight that this movie it's not autobiographical, but it's inspired. I think Luke is probably an amalgamation of people that he knew,
Not one specific.
Or not even like himself. Himself.
Yeah.
If it is supposed to be himself, that's. But one of the guys that gets brought into the prison the same day as Luke is a Navy guy. And they said, oh, we'll have a lot of use for your skill set here. I think that's supposed to be Don Pierce.
Yeah. The only notable cast in this film, and I tried to do more than I normally do. I tried to do a little bit of deep dive through the other actors. I didn't recognize anyone. The only one that I recognize is Paul Newman. And my first run with Paul Newman would have been in the movie Cars, where he played Doc Hudson.
Yeah.
He voiced Doc Hudson.
Well, Paul Newman was a race car driver.
Yeah.
The guy is, what a bizarre character. Famous actor, race car driver.
Salad dressing.
Salad dressings. We've talked about other actors who were also spies and stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if Paul Newman might have been a spy at one point.
Yeah.
There was two other actors I recognized.
So Paul Newman was also in, he's also a couple notable other notable films. Yeah. And some of these may be on the top 250.
He's only got one other top 250.
So he's in Road to Perdition.
Yep.
Which I've only ever heard of by name, so I don't know what that's about. But I know that The Sting.
That's in the top 250.
And he's also Butch Cassidy in The Sundance Kid, where he plays Butch Cassidy.
Yeah, and that was until 2020.
He was in the top. Oh, yeah. Wow.
So and I think Road to Perdition was. I didn't see that one.
But what other cast members did you recognize?
Dragline.
Okay.
So Dragline is like the guy that is Luke before Luke shows up, basically.
Right, right. And they're enemies at the beginning, but by the end, they're companions.
Yeah. And I don't know. I feel like Dragline's character towards the end of the movie, like... The character change becomes somewhat unbelievable because his personality changes so dramatically once he becomes Luke's right-hand man. He becomes kind of a yes man in a weird way. Anyway, that's George Kennedy. What I know him from is the Naked Gun franchise.
See, I'm not seeing those.
He's the captain, basically.
Okay.
And he does great in that, but... This movie is what he's known for, which I didn't know because I know him from Naked Gun. And,
right. And Naked Gun was 20 years after this, right?
Yeah.
Because that was in was that the 70s?
I think 80s.
Okay, so 80s, yeah, 80s, okay, yeah.
And then another actor I recognized in his movie, his name is Tramp, but I don't think I ever heard his name said. That's Harry Dean Stanton. He's in Godfather Part 2, which we have covered. He's in Paris, Texas, which we will cover. He's in The Green Mile, which we will cover. And he was an Alien, which we've covered.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so none of those films came up on IMDb, like in his top four.
Yeah, so Alien, he was... that's fascinating. Remember
is he minor characters in those?
Well, remember at the beginning of Alien, there's the two pilots that, like, they are the ones that are the least interested in being there. And one of them's, like, chain smoking.
Yeah.
That's Harry Dean Stanton.
Okay.
And I recognized his face when I saw him. I was like, I know that I know this guy, but I couldn't tell you what he's from. And then
he's a tramp, but I love him.
And I don't remember him in Godfather Part 2, but apparently he's in it.
Was he the Godfather?
Oh, he was the Godfather.
He was the Godfather. No, no. gotcha. Anything else?
That's it.
On IMDb, this is 8.1 out of 10. Mm-hmm. Currently, as of recording, it's number 244 on the top 250. Mm-hmm. So it's... just there. It's just on the top 250.
It's at risk of falling off.
Yeah. What's the history of this movie on the top 250?
It has always been in the top 250. Its highest was 75.
Ooh.
It's been at a slow descent since 2011.
Before I get to Rotten Tomatoes, I do want to make the comparison because we have to acknowledge, and this came up in almost every time I read an article about this movie.
Okay.
There's another, well, the Green Mile is also on the top 250.
Yeah.
But like, the number one movie on the IMDb top 250 is a prison movie, Shawshank Redemption, which is
Green Mile a prison movie?
Green Mile is a prison movie. I've not seen it, but it is a prison movie.
Okay,
that's the one about Eminem, Stephen Hitch, Stephen
Seagal.
No, not Alfred Hitchcock. Stephen
Spielberg.
No,
I'll just look it up.
Man,
you go ahead and say the other.
The
thing.
Green Mile is a famous. It's based on a famous.
Donald Trump.
No.
I'm pulling it up currently. So
Stephen King. There it is. I knew it was a Stephen. I've not read any of the books, but I've seen some of the movies.
I've never read a book.
Shawshank Redemption is my number one favorite movie. So like, I was immediately going, okay, here's a prison movie. Like, we'll see if maybe the reasons I like Shawshank is because of the prison aspects. It's not because this movie is very different than Shawshank.
Shawshank came after, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I would say
they even take place in different times.
I would say that this movie greatly, because I know Stephen King wrote Shawshank Redemption, which was then adapted to a movie. I would be surprised if this movie or the novel that it's based off were not very influential to Stephen King in writing.
So Shawshank came out in the 90s. The book was wrote in the 80s.
Yeah, this would have been 15, 20 years old at that point. Stephen King,
it was a novella. Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption was the name of it. So, this movie does predate in every way Shawshank. But like, if this wasn't an inspiration for Shawshank in any sort of way or any sort of acknowledgement, I'd be surprised.
Right.
Because like, just Shawshank deals with the day in and day out, the chemistry between inmates, Like, obviously, it's set in a, it's a, it's more
one
modern.
Thing, one thing film. I'd say that Shawshank does differently, and we'll, of course, eventually get to there, is that the main character is, he, so Cool Hand Luke, he's cool.
Yeah.
He's a cool guy.
Yeah.
Maintains his pressure, composure under pressure. He's kind of infallible until later in the movie. I'd say with Shawshank Redemption, he's not the same kind of...
It's not that he's dislikable.
No.
But he comes in meek. He comes in a little a little weak, a little like...
Nerdy.
Nerdy, yeah. And he's also like, they depict him getting assaulted in Shawshank.
Boy, do they.
It's like you see him being beat down, not by the guards, but by the fellow
guards
inmates.
As well.
Never once in this film are the inmates the villains. There is a time where him and...
Dragline,
they go at each other, but after that, they become companions. It's like there is, it's more of just a pecking order type thing.
The worst that happens in this, as far as like, so they establish it very early on. If you're going to fight, you save it for Saturdays. We do not fight in the house.
Right.
And so then we do see one fight in the yard on a Saturday, but the majority of the kind of pecking order type stuff is like tricking new guys into getting in trouble.
Almost hazing.
Yeah. I'd say it's more hazing
than it is bullying, which I know there's a fine line.
I'd say that there's a lot more of an us against them.
Yeah.
Whereas in Shawshank, it's kind of like, I'd say Shawshank is probably more similar to modern prisons than this movie is, in that in this, it's us against them with like an anti-establishment thing. Whereas modern prisons are much more like prison colonies.
Yeah.
Where like, basically, people are free to interact in many situations, and a lot of the conflict is between prisoners, not between prisoners and uniformed officers. Not that I've ever been in one, but that's my understanding.
Yeah. So yeah, so I'm curious to the impact that this film had on Shawshank and its writing. So
I do know that this movie was a revolutionary anti-establishment movie in its time, because this was made during in the lead up to the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So anti-establishment rhetoric was growing, and this was like one of the earliest American movies that was like, hey, maybe the guys in charge aren't always the good guys, you know?
Mm-hmm. Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
100% tomato meter, 95% audience. Yeah. So very high marks. So next up, budget. What was the budget for this film?
$3.2 million, which would be it's basically $30 million today.
That's low. I mean, that's small.
$30 million to make this movie seems like a lot.
But in modern day, big budget, like or big screen films, that's a small number. Yes, sure. for the setting, and it's to my like I don't know, back in the 60s. I don't know if this cast was more reputable back then.
No.
But like,
no, most of these were nobody cast.
But like, yeah, so there's minimal cast. I mean, you're just paying for Paul.
And I think that this was his breakout role.
Yeah. Yeah, because it predates the other movies I mentioned.
Yeah.
That just still seems.
Was he already a known racer at the time? Let me look it up.
I don't know. I don't know if the racing came before the acting, or if it was during, or I have no idea. There's really no way of knowing.
Oh, he was doing Broadway before this. So he was doing Broadway and other movies and stuff. So he was, this was probably like a breakout role for him, but like not.
It wasn't his first role.
Yeah.
When did his racing career?
So his breakthrough role as Rocky Graziano in the film Somebody Up There Likes Me in 1956. 56. That's considered his breakout role.
Okay.
When did he start racing? When did he become a racist? He became interested while training at the Watkins Glen Racing School for the filming of Winning, a 1969 film.
Okay, so after this.
Yeah.
So he didn't race. Okay. He didn't get into racing until after
this. He drove in the Le Mans, the 24-hour.
Yeah.
In the 1979
Le Mans. We talked about
Le Mans,
that.
We probably did. I don't remember.
When we talked about the movie Ferrari.
Yeah.
Or,
he finished in second.
What movie did we do? It was Ford versus Ferrari.
Ford versus Ferrari.
That's right. When we did that film.
Yeah. He came in second in the 1979 Le Mans, which is a 24-hour.
That's impressive.
Hour. That's
really, that's why he plays Doc Hudson in Cars.
That makes sense, yeah. They should have had Frankie Muniz. Name drop?
Yo, many times.
Yeah.
Many times.
The first name drop. Sometimes nothing can be a real cool hand. And then Dragline says, move over. I'm going to sit next to my boy, Cool Hand Luke.
Okay, a couple scenes I want to break down here before we get into some heavier things. Last episode, you had a hard time talking about the rats.
Hell yeah.
This movie had a scene that I had a way harder time watching than many of the rat scenes you talked about. The 50 eggs.
Oh, I want to talk about that.
Like it just
do you think you could eat 50 eggs?
Oh, Lord, no. I'm not anti-egg.
Okay.
I like eggs.
Okay.
But like to eat 50 of them in an hour?
Yeah.
Like,
how do you feel about competitive eating in general?
Horrifying.
Okay.
Like the hot dog eating, was it Memorial Day that they do that?
Yeah.
The Nathan's hot dogs.
Joey Chestnut.
Like, I find it impressive, but I also hate it at the exact same time. It is disgusting.
It is.
And I can't watch it.
It's
gluttony at its finest.
Yeah.
Even if you're just doing it for sport.
It is.
But like, it's gluttony.
Sure.
And I can't. It's disgusting. And like, even though I know they didn't eat 50 eggs, they said Paul ate about only 8 eggs in the filming of that. Like every other time was off camera, or like,
I know,
or he spit them back out. I know
at least 2 of the shots of him eating an egg were recycled.
Correct.
Because I just saw that
line. So this was on IMDb in one of the stats. Like, he specifically ate only about 8 eggs in the filming of that, but they did make 50 or so eggs for the scene to have around on set.
Yeah.
And so the rest of the set ate them after filming. They said the next day or the couple hours after,
protein farts,
everyone smelled so bad. Like they said, like, and it was just mutually, everyone was just ripping them.
Yeah.
And they just kept moving.
So there's a couple YouTubers I watch that are competitive eaters. There was that TV show Man versus Food.
Yeah.
Like I'm interested.
I liked that show. For some reason, that didn't bother me, but the hot dog thing in the eggs did.
Yeah, so some of the things in competitive eating I find really gross. Like with the Nathan's hot dog eating contest, they dip the bread in water. That's disgusting to me.
Yeah.
But I was like, all right, 50 eggs. I'm sure somebody on YouTube who does competitive eating has done this. So I Googled the first result, Joey Chestnut.
He did it. Ew.
Guess how long it took Joey Chestnut to eat 50 peeled hard-boiled eggs?
20 minutes.
4 minutes and 25 seconds.
There's no way.
Yeah.
And there's probably video. Is there a video of it?
Yep, it's linked below.
I'm not watching
When
that.
He became a competitive eater, when he started doing competitive eating, his grandfather was like, Cool Hand Luke's one of my favorite movies. You've got to do it. And he put it off for years because it's like, 50 eggs is not that hard, apparently. But he did it just for his grandfather. I can't remember specifically why that episode, but he did.
They said in the film, 50 eggs is about 6 pounds.
Of eggs.
6 pounds of eggs. Yeah. And when they hit his belly at the end or whatever, or like...
Yeah.
And it was just... It was in the middle of him eating. And they hit it and it was just...
There's a YouTuber called...
I struggled with that scene so much.
There's a YouTuber called Beard versus Food.
Okay.
And he travels around... mostly in England, but he's come to the States a few times, and he goes to places that like restaurants that have an eating challenge, and he films it and beats it. And mostly he does it like as promotion for them. Right. Which is how a lot of competitive eaters make their money, is promoting the restaurants that they're eating at.
Right.
And he's only failed like 3 or 4 challenges in the history of a series. I didn't look up to see if he'd done the 50 eggs because almost every, I don't think I've seen him do anything that was like in his own house. Everything I've seen him do
as a restaurant
is at a restaurant. But yeah, Joey Chestnut, 50 eggs, 4 minutes and 25 seconds.
Four and a half minutes.
I'd like to see Guinness Records start tracking that one. I want to see if somebody can beat 4.5 minutes for 50 eggs.
That's horrifying.
One of the things they say leading up to that scene is if he eats an egg every minute, he only has 10 minutes left, which is true. 60 minutes in an hour. I feel like eating an egg a minute, I could eat 50 eggs in an hour.
I wouldn't wish that on you. I like eggs. I think hard-boiled eggs are the worst rendition of eggs.
Oh, absolutely.
And like, no. Why? No, don't do that.
I'm not saying I'm going to. I have no interest in doing it.
But if you pay enough in our Patreon, if you... this scene was... Okay, so obviously this scene takes place way before the ending, the graveyard scene. Well, the grave digging scene. This was, for me, this was the hardest moment in the movie up until that scene, the grave scene. But I, Yeah, I struggled with that scene so bad.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I was expecting him to Ralph. Mm-hmm. Just like...
Ralph yeah. Wiggum's from The Simpsons? Mm-hmm. I'm in trouble.
Yeah. I've never watched The Simpsons.
Oh.
So, yeah, that was... I had to mention that.
Well, let's pivot then to the digging scene.
Okay. I didn't know if you wanted to wait until... No, okay.
Earlier in the movie, there's a scene where they're tossing soil onto tar.
Correct.
To pave
the truck's laying the tar down, and they're trying to finish before sunset because then they would get any time afterwards. They would get to relax.
They don't know that.
But then, what were they rushing for? I thought that was the whole thing. The reason that they sped up and they ran was because they were going to get time afterwards to chill.
That's what I want to talk about, because they didn't know that they were going to get time off.
Okay, so go ahead then.
The jail guards were just like, what do we do with them? And they're like, oh, I guess we just have the rest of the day off.
Okay.
The line is, the man wants speed, let's give him speed. And it's like just a pride in a job well done.
Right.
And it reminded me of the story out of the concentration camps in Europe during World War II.
Never heard of them? That was before me.
I was a guard. And... No, there was this one particular concentration camp, the Jewish men, their spirit could not be broken. Any job they gave them, the men were like, well, you know, it's important to make shoes because we've got to protect feet. It's important to make good ammunition because if it explodes in a gun, it'll hurt somebody. Like, they could find reason for any of the work. And the way they broke their spirit was one day they sent them out to dig a huge hole. And they said, the men told themselves, well, you know, we don't know what this hole is for, but, you know, it could be anything. It could be for a mass grave. And it's important that we dig this hole properly so that we can give the bodies the respect that we can give them, right? The guards aren't going to respect the bodies, but we can do the best we can to do the best hole we can dig. And then the next day, the guards said, all right, dig a second hole. And they dug the second hole. And they're like, okay, take the dirt from the first hole, put it in the second hole, and the dirt from the second hole, put it. And they did this until the men's spirit was broken. This went on for weeks. And then later in the movie, we get them doing the same thing to him. And I was like, I don't know if this was a story that they knew, right? But like, it was really interesting to me that the same technique. And I had made that connection. And then when we got to the scene, I was like, oh my goodness, they did it.
Now, I've heard of, not necessarily the hole digging, but like, what I saw play out in this scene, I've heard is done in military all the time. Like the whole, like, you got one sergeant going, stand up soldier or do this.
Yeah.
And then you got another one going, get down and give me 20. Like these two individual leaders
and you have to follow
giving
them.
Opposing instructions.
Yep.
So like, I've not heard the story you just shared, but like this type of punishment or this type of discipline I've heard of before. But this scene was hard to watch. And I didn't know how this movie was going to end. Like when they knocked him in the grave, like I thought he was dead.
Mm.
Like when he fell with the shovel and he was just laying there, I was like, was that it?
Yeah.
Like, did they just kill him off?
And then
like,
when he was begging at his feet, I thought for real that they had broken him. And that gets really complicated later.
It does get complicated.
Cause Dragline's like, oh, you tricked them. He's like, no, I didn't trick him. That was real. But if they broke him, why is he... like escaping again.
Yeah.
He acts like a real butt dog in that scene until he escapes.
Yeah. I mean, can you can, well, okay, this would be a good example of torture, right? Torture.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
torture would bring out, torture could, and maybe most likely will make someone do something that they wouldn't necessarily do any other time. So in that moment, it could have broke him, but right after, he's going to go back to the same Cole and Luke. So that could be a very good depiction of like that begging was sincere. He wanted that moment to stop.
Yeah.
But it didn't change him for the rest of his life. He's going to go, he's going to be who he's always going to be once he regains some of his energy.
Well, like, let's pivot from here to something that,
pivot.
We talked. Oh, please don't.
It's from Friends.
I hate that so much. I love helping people move.
It's, you can't help someone move without that being referenced. It's annoying.
If somebody references that, I always make it clear, like, listen, I'm happy to help you move. But if somebody references this, I'm leaving. And I've done it before. I'm like, hey, great job here, guys. Clearly you don't need me anymore. You got enough hands. I'm leaving now. I hate that joke. But I love helping people move. Anyway, pivoting to, we covered this when we did Paddington 2 for Off 250. If you are not subscribed to our Patreon and you want to hear our thoughts on Paddington 2, linked below.
Also a prison movie.
there's a, and you said, I said that we started talking about prison. I was like, this is really something I want to save for Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah, for the Gen Pop.
One of the things that we talked about briefly is recidivism.
Where you hold on to receipts too long after you go to shopping.
That's right. And then the receipt expires.
Correct. Yeah. And you can't exchange anything. You
can't exchange it anymore.
Recidivism.
So recidivism is the rate at which people, ex-convicts, commit crimes again, mm-hmm. specifically the same crime, but really just crimes in general. Do you think that the way that the prisoners are handled in this movie will prevent repeated crimes?
Say that again?
Do you think the treatment of these prisoners will prevent repeated crimes? Do you think that the negative reinforcement shown here, the punishment and torture for having committed the crime shown here, will be a sufficient deterrent to future crime?
I don't know. Like, I don't know if I can answer this question in any depiction of prison discipline. Because, like, I don't know. Hold on, let me process this for a second. I don't know what universally, and I don't, okay, in that, saying it that way, I don't think universally you can use the same tactic for everyone and expect to get the same results when it comes to discipline and
education and anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I do think, like, people were built differently, were designed differently, and we require accommodating things to progress. Yeah. And in the prison system, I don't think the specific scenario we see in Cool Hand Luke, I don't think it would have an 100%
recidivism.
Criticism.
Yeah.
Hippie season.
Christening.
Like, I don't think it would be 100% anywhere. Like, I think you're still going to get, like, the act of, okay, so for example, in this movie, Luke, we see him try to escape three different times.
Yeah.
Where, okay, in this movie, he is guilty. He, like, he got arrested for an act that he did commit. Yeah. He was not trying to get in there for some other reason. Nope. He was not falsely accused. Nope. He was guilty.
Drunk and disorderly.
Yeah. And he was trying to escape three times.
Why was he trying to escape? Do you remember? He was happy to just
prison
serve.
Sucks.
No, he was happy to just serve his time until his mom died.
His mom died, yeah. Like, there's going to be other factors in every person's life that's going to require them to make decisions. So, like, if someone serves time in prison, mm-hmm. and you observe that they look like they're becoming, what's the word I want to use? They're remolded. No, what's the word? They're turned around. Like, they're becoming,
yeah, rehabilitated.
Rehabilitated. There's the word. But then they go back to live in an environment where their home life, their family life, their social circle is all continuing to do the same thing. They would have to leave all that and go start, like it's not as easy once you get on the outside to go start a new life.
Right.
Especially if you're going back to the same environment that got you put in prison.
And if you've been in prison for a sufficient amount of time, right, that's your new normal.
You could be rehabilitated, but then if you're going to go, it's like, you can't assume that every one of those people that are going to leave prison are going to go back to a new life.
Right.
It's like, I think there's more factors on the outside that affect
redistributionism
than what happens on the inside.
Sure. There's also, and I mentioned it there briefly, there's a thing where, and actually, sorry, let's first talk about the Appalachian Trail. Totally unrelated.
Hiking.
Yeah. There are people that will hike the Appalachian Trail. Takes about 6 months. They get to the end and they're like, well, I've been doing this for 6 months. This is my new normal. I don't really want to go back to the way life was before, so I guess I'm just going to keep going. And they'll hike across Canada and then through the Sierras and, you know.
Then through the oceans.
Yeah. That same thing happens with people that get released from prison. They're like, well, I kind of had it good in there. You know, three hot meals, no responsibilities. Like, I had a routine. Yep. I had my people.
Yep.
As long as I didn't make trouble, I was fine. The amount of liberty I have now is kind of uncomfortable, and the responsibility that comes with that. I'll just commit some crimes and go back.
What is
and
that does happen. What is that called?
Like Stockholm Syndrome, sort of, but not quite.
Because you see this played out in Shawshank.
Yes.
The old guy. I forget the old Red guy's name. Red. Yeah. No. Red's Samuel Jackson. No, Red is Morgan Freeman. There's the old... Is Red... I haven't watched this movie in a while. I've been waiting to watch
it
first. I've
seen it once, and it's been years.
I've seen it multiple times. There is a character named, I can't remember if Red is Morgan Freeman's character, who doesn't do that, but there's an elderly character who finally gets released, and he ends up...
Just coming back.
He hangs himself.
Oh, that's right.
Because he can't live on the outside. Yes. I forget the term. There's a specific term.
But that exists.
So yeah, it does. And it's common.
Yeah.
That's a
major part of recidivism.
Right. So I think there...
And even in this context of this movie, where they have it so bad,
right,
you could get used to it.
More factors on the outside have to change to prevent recidivism than on the inside. There needs to be post-release, there needs to be
parole
or someone at least going, hey, let me check in on you. Let me make sure you're doing for 5 months, 6 months, 10 months.
Who pays for that? Who do you think should?
Should? I don't know. I mean, it's our tax dollars, right? For the public prison system, it's our tax
money. Oh, yeah. Okay. Who currently does? We do.
We do. But who should? I don't know how I would redesign that. I don't know where I would... If taxing wasn't a thing, I don't know how I would redo that.
Let me ask you another question.
The church. I don't know.
We've talked about... I don't disagree with that answer. I think that's a great answer. I think the church can be more actively involved in that. We've talked in the past about my, we'll say...
Criminal lifestyle?
Yeah. My reservations about public schooling.
Yeah.
And we touched on it just now, where you said, you know, there's no one-size-fits-all for... how you rehabilitate a criminal.
Agreed.
Or punish a criminal.
Agreed.
And I said, just like with education, right? Because with education, no two kids learn the same.
Right. And I never disagree with you on
right,
that part.
Right.
I absolutely agree. One thing that we've agreed
on is that other options besides public schooling, right? Now, my position is public schooling doesn't work. Your position is we need to encourage as many options as possible.
Correct. Because... people have been successful in the public school system.
Right.
So it has worked.
It has worked.
Yes. It's not the best option for everyone.
Right.
And I agree with you.
It's not the right. It's not the best option for anyone. I agree. So similarly.
Yeah.
How do we take that same concept and apply it to prisons? How do we make it so that we have a variety of options
for rehabilitating
and punishing criminals?
Yeah.
That meets the needs of the criminal.
But also keeps us safe from someone who could potentially be dangerous.
Right.
The public. Keeps right. the public safe. Because that's the one thing with most... that's the one difference between prisons and schools. One. It's the only one. It's the only difference.
There is a shocking amount of similarities with prisons
But assuming...
they use the same transportation,
assuming
trays,
students aren't dangerous. That's the one thing is like, students aren't meant to keep people out of public.
Sure.
Prisons are.
Yes.
Students, in my mind, are training people to be more public friendly or more publicly. We don't have to get into that. But
getting back to my question.
Correct.
How then?
I don't know.
I think a free society addresses this problem pretty well.
With the diverse discipline of criminals.
Yeah.
Okay. How so?
So.
And where is this being done currently?
That is the harder thing to answer.
Okay.
So, Bob Murphy. And I'm going to link this below. He recently did a seminar, a speech.
TED Talk?
Not quite a TED Talk, but similar. Explaining from the ground up, right? Starting from scratch, how could you do policing and security and all that?
Really?
Yeah. And it's like an hour long. And a lot of times these kinds of conversations look like, instead of this, we do this. And he doesn't do instead of. He just starts from the ground up like, this is needed, so this is how we address it. This is needed, and this is how we address it. And he lays a foundation and builds on that. I don't think he discussed prisons.
Okay.
I think I know he has, but I don't think he did it in this
video. In this talk was specifically policing and...
police and security.
Okay.
The privatization of police and security. So how do you privatize prisons in a way that still respects the autonomy and rights of the criminal? Because you can't just abduct them and force them into a building, because that... violates their rights.
Are you sure? All right, hold on a second.
Gotta go take care of some things.
I get it.
But let's propose a hypothetical society where you don't have a government deciding who is and isn't allowed in buildings. You leave that up to private individuals. It's entirely plausible that like to get into buildings, like to go to Sam's Club, for example. What do you need to get into Sam's Club?
A membership.
So that's not outside the question.
Same with Costco.
Yes. So that concept already exists in our society. And what kind of things do you need to get a membership?
Money.
And?
An ID.
An ID. Now, let's say that the government's not handing out IDs. Insurance would probably suit, like, work there as well, right? You're showing both that you're reputable enough to have insurance and you're verifying your identification.
In a lot of places, if you don't have ID, you can use a pay stub or a letter, like a mailing, something with your mailing address on it, with your name on it.
Yeah, something that verifies your identity and verifies that you're somewhat responsible.
Yeah.
So it's not out of the question that this becomes normal in such a society that government's not managing these things. Well, if I'm a criminal...
Brooks was the character in Shawshank.
Thank you.
That the old man read as Morgan Freeman. Okay, continue. If you're the character,
if I'm a recidivist criminal, I'm just constantly causing trouble. It's going to be hard for me to get insurance, first of all, because insurance is like, no, you cost us too much money,
right?
And I can't afford the premium that there will like because you're so dangerous, we would take you, but this is the premium that's going to cost you, and I can't afford it,
right?
Well, now there's like all kinds of buildings that just won't let me in because I'm not a reputable person.
Yeah, and how are you doing so far?
Not great.
Okay. All right, keep going.
And then, you know, the roads, to get on the roads, I need insurance as well because most of the private road companies don't let people on without insurance because that's, you know, their insurance depends on it. So very quickly, I become somebody who cannot live in society. So I have to go outside of society. But I still have needs, and it hasn't violated my rights at all because it's all the private citizens saying, hey, you're not allowed on our property because you're dangerous. But I still have needs. It's not out of the question that philanthropic organizations or businesses even would start things like road crews, right? And like, hey, you live on our compound. We'll feed you. We'll house you. We'll do all that stuff. And in fact, this is going to work like a credit score thing where we're rehabilitating your credit score. We're also going to rehabilitate you with the insurance companies. We work with this insurance company that after you do X amount of time, you know, they'll give you a reduced premium. Blah, blah, blah. Like all of this can exist in a society and all of that's been voluntary. And let's say that I'm that recidivist criminal that's now working on a road crew because I can't be trusted anywhere else. And this particular prison treats me very terribly, right? Like they say like, hey, if you question us, you have to sleep in this box for a night. And I hear about down the road, another road crew that doesn't do that. Why? It's like, okay, I'm going to end my contract with this road crew. I'm going to go work with the other road crew. I have to start from scratch now. They're working with a different insurance company. It doesn't transfer over, blah, blah, blah. Like all these different things that might happen. But still, even my rights as the criminal have been respected. Nobody's rights have been violated.
My only question would be is, as a criminal, should you have the same rights?
That is the question, isn't it?
Yeah. And I don't necessarily have an answer.
Right.
Because like, as humans,
right,
we should have... basic rights,
but I think,
but at the sometimes, like if you abuse your ability to be a
functioning member
functioning
of society.
Society, there should be some more form of punishment rather than you just got to go work road crew and that's it.
Or, well, and it could be other things,
other jobs.
But the reason I bring this up is because if we acknowledge that one size doesn't fit all, then the only way to address that is if they have rights. If they don't have rights, then we're going to fall into a one-size-fits-all.
Right. And so is there any other countries that are doing incarceration differently or prison discipline anything differently? Like, does everyone around the world do prison the same way or discipline?
No.
Okay. So what are some other places doing?
I know that there are some Scandinavian countries where, honestly, the prisons look more like high-end hotels.
So they still have a prison system, but it's not...
It's more like a high-end prison colony.
Okay.
Where like there are guards and stuff on duty, but like the people that live there come and go as they please, but like come and go within the infrastructure as they please. And it's
hold
larger.
My calls till I get
it's,
back.
It's more like a retirement community than anything else with a gate, right? Mm-hmm. And they've been showing some pretty promising results as far as recidivism in these contexts. But my concern still is, well, if you make it better than their life outside,
then
why wouldn't they just
try to get in?
You've created the incentive for them to just return. Right.
Yeah. And so to keep on this subject, but I did think about this in this movie in moments, and I've used this term before, but like not in this movie kind of romanticizes prison in some ways.
It does.
Cause like, in and I'm not saying this movie's pro-prison.
Similar to how Godfather romanticizes criminal behavior.
Correct. And like, and I will say there's probably moments in Shawshank,
yes,
especially
absolutely.
Especially the moments between Tim Robbins' character and Morgan Freeman's character,
yeah.
like the bond that they created.
Yeah.
And this like there's some like optimistic perspectives in this, and I've not seen Green Mile, but like
I'm sure it's just
it is hard to make prison something that's unattractive or criminal discipline something that's unattractive, but at the same time make it something that's
human
and functional.
Well,
and
I know that
life-giving.
Like, I know that even into the 19th century or 20th century, within the last 100 years in France. Birdies.
Is those birds? Okay. I was like, something's in here. But
you might be hearing birds in the background.
We've got the garage door open.
We can't
today.
Really fix that. I'll strip them if I can, but...
Well, that's just disrespectful.
Birds
take
don't
your,
have rights.
Take your feathers off, birds. Anyways.
Something about breasts and thighs.
Yeah.
Anyway. I know in France, even until relatively recently, their prisons, like by American standards, would have been considered inhuman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like damp and dark, and you don't see the light of day for days at a
probably
time.
Probably food is probably sparse when it's given, and it's
rats,
yeah,
right, all that stuff.
Almost like what you'd expect in biblical times, like
yeah. I know that certain Latin America, and for the large part, that type of prison is largely tied to the economics of the country. But France specifically, like they were doing well, and they were still imprisoning in what we consider inhuman conditions. But then that comes back to the question of what are the rights of the criminal?
Right.
Does the criminal have rights?
Right.
I think that if you have a government, one of the things that I used to really struggle with in the Bible is in the Psalms, after David uses his authority to take advantage of Bathsheba, in the Psalms he writes, "Lord, I have sinned against you and you alone." And I always struggle with that because, well, what about Bathsheba? What about her husband, Uriah, yeah. that you had killed?
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. What about your other wives? And one thing that I kind of was able to better understand after becoming a libertarian is that, specifically a Christian libertarian, is that if all things are fundamentally God's, he has property ownership over everything. And so anytime you break rules of any kind,
harm someone else, something against someone else,
you are also offending God
yeah.
by offending his property. In a state, the government is God. All things belong to the government, and you have it at their pleasure, right? If the government decides that you don't deserve anything that you have, they reserve the right to take it from you, right? And so with that would be any civil rights you have. So it would be a government's privilege within the context of having a government to say, no, prisoners don't have rights. But we as a society have decided, no, they do have some, right? Like, yeah. We've taken away... firing squads in a lot of advanced countries and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I just think there's an interesting tension there.
Is you and my next question for you is going to be a biblical question. Like, is there a biblical structure for what prison looks like? I know what we see in the Bible of when people are depicted in prison, of yeah. it's not great. They're chained to the wall. There's like, it's bad. But like for modern, for us people in 2024, like reading the Bible and people that may be in the criminal rehabilitation career field, like,
yeah.
Is there anything in the Bible that would give structure or lay base to something that would give us an idea of like, how are we as fellow humans supposed to take care of lawbreakers? Being that in God's eyes, we're all lawbreakers, but we do have structure, like, is there anything in the Bible that gives us a structural yeah. basis of how we should take care of criminals?
That's an excellent question. And I'd never considered it. I know Leviticus talks a lot about if you violate the law in this specific way, this is the punishment for mm-hmm. it. And I can't off the top of my head think of any that involved imprisonment. So I just asked ChatGPT. The Old Testament
our
does
third
contain.
Member,
yeah, sorry,
our third guest.
I asked, does the Old Testament provide any instruction for imprisonment? The Old Testament does contain references to imprisonment, although it doesn't provide detailed instructions or regulations specifically for imprisonment as we might understand them in a modern context. Instead, it often mentions instances where individuals were held captive or imprisoned as a form of punishment or containment.
Yeah.
One notable example is Joseph's imprisonment in Egypt, as described in the book of Genesis. Though Joseph was falsely accused by his master's wife and was thrown into prison, where he remained for a period of time. However, during his imprisonment, Joseph's abilities caught the attention of the prison warden, eventually leading to his release and rise to prominence in Egyptian society. And he was not imprisoned by Jews, so like that doesn't meet our answer of what does God instruct.
Right.
Right. Another example is the imprisonment of Samson in the book of Judges. Samson, after being betrayed by Delilah, was captured by the Philistines, who gouged out his eyes and imprisoned him. However, during his captivity, Samson's strength was restored, and he ultimately brought down the temple of the Philistine god Dagon, killing himself and many Philistines in the process. Again, they don't follow Jewish instruction of law, and these examples, among others, demonstrate that imprisonment was indeed a concept known in the Old Testament, often as a consequence of wrongdoing or as a means of subjugation by an enemy.
Yeah.
However, there are no detailed legal or procedural guidelines for imprisonment as we would find them in modern legal system. I do know we have outlines for capital punishment. We have outlines for remediation for violence and theft. I can't think of any instruction in the Old Testament of when and how to imprison.
And there's a tension there because, like, obviously God's message is a message of love. Like, and it's a message of love your neighbor, do unto the least of these.
I would say it's a message of righteousness,
correct,
and upright living.
Correct.
Yes.
But in general, like, I think our expectations as Christians, and it's just as good humans, is if you see someone in need, help them.
Yeah.
And the least of these, I think, would include people that are imprisoned.
Oh, for sure.
Modern day. So but in the same time, there is a tension of, like, God also says, if you're willing to do something of the crime, you need to be willing to pay the time. He uses different words,
he uses if you steal, you repay stolen, right?
Right.
If you do violence, right, you repay violence, or you compensate for that,
right,
violence.
So there is this idea of wrongdoing,
yeah,
but not necessarily a structure of which that's universal,
right,
for us to, like, okay, well, this is how we should set up discipline for criminals,
right?
So it's just all I know, like, from the Bible is, like, we're supposed to love for him and care for him. Whether it's individually or as a church or as a community, like, they're still humans. They still exist. They still need to be seen.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there is repayment that needs to be made for an act that they did that was unlawful.
Right.
I clearly don't know what the answer is, but, like, I feel like some things can be reformed, if not all. Like, I don't know what that would be. I don't have the faintest idea of, like, what I would change. Like, I know there's some people I probably wouldn't want on the street.
Sure.
As me and my daughter and my wife are walking down the street. But in other times, there's probably a lot of people imprisoned for stupid things that shouldn't be in there, where they should just have something else. Something else should be done to cater to what the mistake they made to rehabilitate them.
Yeah.
I don't think everything deems prison.
And then on the other hand, right, we've, in the last 10 years or so, had a lot of criminal justice reform, the result of which has been violent criminals being released, no cash bail, right?
Yeah.
And that's obviously not a solution.
No.
And then because we have dramatically changed how we handle mental illness in the criminal justice system, that the result of that has just been tons of homeless.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like there's... And neither of those are safe solutions.
No.
for the individuals or for the people that have to live near them, right?
Right. It's toxic for both.
Yeah. And I think the problem here, and I know that this just goes fundamentally into my biases, is that we've handled all control and decision making over this to a single entity and said, you guys need to, the government must solve it.
Big pharma.
Yeah, big pharma. Big soda. Big soda. you, the government, have to solve this,
yeah,
and they can only try one solution at a time, right? So...
Do you think, I guess I know the answer to this, but just to kind of dig a little deeper, like, in a libertarian society,
yeah,
theoretical libertarian society, who would be in charge of punishing criminals?
Well,
if would it be the state, the city, the county, like, or do none of those have established leaders? Like, if someone gets wronged by someone else in a libertarian society, who's the leader that would then go, okay, you need to do this, criminal?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so where would that leadership come from, and where would, mm-hmm, what would that look like?
Let's give a hypothetical situation.
Okay.
Let's say that you and I are neighbors.
Can I be the criminal?
Sure.
Yes.
I usually do this with myself as the criminal, just because people get weird when they're like, well, I would never do that. I'm like, that's not the point.
That doesn't sound anything like me. No, I want to be the criminal.
Okay. We're neighbors.
I would never do that. All right, okay.
All right, we're neighbors. You covet my television, and so you break into my house and you take it. And
I would do that.
I file an insurance claim saying, hey, my rights were violated here. Somebody broke into my house. They stole my stuff. They launched an investigation. They determined that it was you that did it. They contact first your insurance and say, hey, we have on our books that Jeff gets insurance through you. Your client violated our client's rights in this way, and we demand compensation in this way. Your premium goes up, or you get billed for it, or however. But that's pretty immediate results. Now, let's say that you're...
So, and that would just be you as the neighbor going to your insurance provider.
Yep.
And so, okay. So,
and they all... But let's say...
So no police involved, no police report.
At this point, no.
Just, okay. Okay.
But let's say, hypothetically, to kind of drive the tension, let's say that your insurance says, no, wasn't him. Okay. And so they take it to, they compare their list of arbiters that they work with. And
people who make trees.
Yes.
Yes.
They compare the list of free market judges that they work with, and they settle on one that they both find respectable, who makes good decisions. He looks at the evidence presented by both sides, and he decides who's in the right and who's in the wrong. If my insurance company is in the wrong, they're probably just going to be on the hook for the legal fees. And if your insurance company is in the wrong, they'll be on the hook for the legal fees and the damages. Let's take it a layer further. Let's say that your insurance company is so sure that even after the decision is made, that they're actually going to put some of the security guards that they have on retainer around your house to make sure that my insurance company can't collect on the television back. So now we have the tension rising to possibly a hot conflict between two sets of private security.
Real hot.
Real hot. Two sets of private security. The private security, they don't want violence because violence is expensive, because now, like, let's say one of their agents gets shot.
And they're not politicians.
They're not politicians. They have nothing to gain. So because the two security companies now have conflict, they actually have an incentive to also resolve this. And let's say that the two security companies say, actually, there was already a decision made on this. And so if you insist that we defend this property, we're actually going to break our contract with you. We're not going to work with you anymore. That's what your rights enforcement department says to your your insurance. So that's one way that this could be resolved pretty quickly. Now, let's say that my insurance company contacts your insurance company, and right away your insurance company's like, yeah, you know, he's actually done this several times before. That's why
also his sounds like me.
Yeah. Like, yeah,
repeat that, offender.
We're not even going to investigate. We've been down this road before. It's definitely him. We'll be notifying him that he'll be paying this to you directly out of pocket, and he no longer has insurance with us. Okay?
Ouch.
So you're contacted, and you've already sold the TV, though, and spent the money.
That also, yeah, that's something, yeah.
And so when my insurance company contacts you...
Had to buy some new Funko Pops.
My insurance company contacts you, they serve you a notice, hey, you owe this amount of money, and you don't have insurance to cover it because your insurance has dropped you. Okay, well, you still owe that money. So there's a few options now. You can set up a payment plan, and my insurance company will repay me directly immediately, and you pay my insurance over time plus interest. But let's say that you refuse that. So then, okay, well, now we're going to send some of our rights enforcement agents to come and collect property from you that can be used to compensate. But let's say that you further refuse. You decide, I'm going to get violent over this. And so you defend yourself against these agents, seeing it
with
as...
my nunchucks.
With your nunchucks. Not your nunchucks.
My nunchucks.
Yeah, your nunchucks. Yeah, because your N-U-N chucks are too devout for violence.
Right, yes. This is all gold.
So yeah. Let's say that you're going to be wildly overpowered. Mm-hmm. And so you flee. Well, now because your insurance has dropped you, you're on the hook for money, there's a warrant out for your arrest.
That's true.
To pay for it. Like, so far, all of this has really flowed out very similar to what we'd see. But the incentive to de-escalate and reduce violence is much higher. Because violence is expensive if you have to pay for it. The state doesn't have to pay for violence. The taxpayer does. And so there's actually very little incentive to de-escalate in a normal state. But let's say, you know, we're 6 months out. They haven't caught you. But still nobody will take you for insurance. there's entire cities that you can't even step into because you're not insured, you refuse to be insured, blah, 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 blah. Well, what are your options now? You still have food needs. You still have shelter needs. You could try and live off grid, and that's probably what some criminals will do. And so certain areas will become dangerous, but most land is going to be owned in a private society. So even the forested areas, like, there's a chance that you get caught and chased off the land and you get tired of being on the run. Well, what's your option? Well, you find one of these companies that you can work for that you can rehabilitate your insurance score with by doing, they cover your room and board. You get paid a very, very small wage, and they sell your service or product or whatever to cover their costs, right? That's how this would shake out in a free society, I suspect. Does that mean that there won't be times where it does escalate to violence? No. Obviously, it's going to escalate to violence at sometimes. People are violent. The original crime could have been that instead of stealing my TV, you came in and killed me.
Assaulted you.
Right? And now it's my family who is owed damages or whatever. It's a free society isn't utopian in the concept that there will never be crime.
It does require leadership. Right? But, like people would have to take charge in specific situations and lead specific things. So like, sure. There would still be a hierarchy of powers in different moments.
Yeah.
Maybe not over their whole lifestyle. And all of it
voluntary.
Right.
Yeah.
But like, because in those moments, the insurance agency, the hired guards and stuff, they would have
authority within that situation.
Yes.
Yep. And for example, even the security guard, right? The security guard is answering to the insurance company as a client. So the insurance company kind of has authority even still.
Yeah.
Right? Like and then there's always like layers to that hierarchy. Technically the judge has more authority than the insurance companies, but all of that has been voluntary submission and like client based. Mm-hmm. I see that as the ideal situation for how to handle these issues. So it's fair to say that libertarianism is idealistic. It's not honest. It's not fair to say it's utopian.
Is there any places, and I know I've asked you this question a couple of times, just because like there are some things that I have easier time putting faith in.
Sure.
Versus I need to see this played out.
Yeah.
Are there any places across the globe that do anything close to what you're describing?
Yeah.
And how does that work for them?
In America. All over America, private arbitration happens constantly between companies.
Here in the States.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Constantly.
Okay.
Because it's more efficient to go through private courts than public courts. So companies suing each other often aren't going to use the government to do it. They're going to use private courts to do it.
Okay.
And when you remove the monopoly of the public courts, the private courts now have competition incentive to lower their costs, become more accessible. The private courts are already way more efficient. You know, and so if we opened up private courts to all of these issues, like all these crimes get solved so much faster.
How would a judicial system? No, I'm a little off topic, but just in this scenario, like,
if
how would we go about getting a judicial system then if we don't have like would it still be a voting system or like? Like would voting be different in a liberal, like,
would it
like
be how judges would we, or would it be juries? Right,
how would we establish judges, juries, all that stuff?
Yeah.
Like, what would that look like in this scenario if we don't have what we know as a democratic government? Like, how would these judges be put into position?
Okay. Well, if we were to have juries, you have to ask yourself, what's the incentive structure to create a jury? In America, the incentive structure is that if you would like the right to vote, you also have to be willing to serve on a jury if it comes up. I can see a situation where there is a judge firm, right, an arbitration firm that says, "Hey, you through your insurance, you can have us as an option, and we're going to give you a super cheap rate if you're willing to come and be on our jury, maybe through our random polling." Mm-hmm. So it's possible that juries could still exist. The incentive structures are there. Like, it makes sense that it would still show up, right? Because people would want inexpensive arbitration at times. And that's what...
So they would just be an establishment that provides that.
Yeah. Like some of the arbitration services would probably use that as their competitive advantage. I think most arbitration services, though, it's just going to be like, hey, this guy, you know, bat in 1,000. Every single one of his decisions, all the other arbiters, when they've reviewed the case, have been like, yeah, it's a really good decision. So.
Okay, cool. I like hearing these, like,
alternative.
These scenarios help me understand what a libertarian,
what a free society might
free
look like.
Society would look like. Yeah. So like, cause some of the things we talk about, I'm like, okay, sure. I get it. But like, but hearing it played out and like seeing things, obviously like we've never lived in it. So there'd probably be some things that we wouldn't think of that would happen. Of course, the way these events would play out, that would change maybe some things minutely, mm-hmm. but in general, it's cool to, it's fascinating to hear these things play out. So I was very fascinated by that example.
Yeah.
So,
I appreciate
you're completely wrong.
I appreciate the opportunity.
If a dictator was in place, then we'd never have this issue ever again.
That's right. I appreciate the opportunity because this is a sticking point that a lot of people have for free society concepts that I understand why it's a sticking point, and it's never been appropriate in any of the previous movies to really discuss it. And that's when we started watching this. I was like, oh, this is something that I definitely want to discuss. Mm. Yeah. I have something entirely unrelated to bring up from the movie. But unrelated to free society.
Sure, go ahead, I guess. Yeah.
When Luke is speaking with his mother, she says, "Sometimes I wish people were like dogs. Come a time, a day like when a just don't recognize the pups no more, so she don't have no hopes, nor love to give her pain. She just don't give a And then Luke says to her, "You've done your best, Arlita. What I've done to myself is my own problem." I thought this was a really interesting interaction.
No, that was... You see a lot of humanity in that moment.
Yeah.
And like with it being a dying mom and a son that's incarcerated.
Yeah.
You could have seen it played out differently and also been like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like you could have seen mm-hmm. him weeping over her and yeah. she mourning her son being incarcerated. Like this, like the fact that they both had cool hands. Like they both just kept it cool. Like they talked about heavy things.
Yeah.
But like, but still in the moment, they kept a level head.
Yep.
Yeah. And I appreciate that whole interaction in general, but like, I think that's the easy way out. What specifically she said
yeah.
about how it'd be nice to just be able to forget and unrecognize your pups.
Yeah.
Like that's the easy way out. Like,
I don't even know if that's true.
Well, or that dogs do that.
Yeah.
I have no idea, but her scenario, yeah. Yeah. like that's just, like,
I wish I could not care.
Right. Like that's a cop out. Like that's, yeah. that shows weakness.
I think.
Like
no, I think it's a very honest,
absolutely
statement
to be able to want to get rid of that. Yes,
like, I wish I could just not care about how you've chose to live your life. Right. I think that that's a
brutally honest. Yes, yeah. But I don't think that's something that in every situation we'd want.
Yeah,
like because for most parts in our life, I'm assuming.
Yeah,
I've had a pretty blessed life in general. Like to forget one thing would mean you'd have to forget everything, and like. I imagine, you know, that there was probably way more stuff in their childhood that she probably would want to hold on to
oh, sure.
versus just the fact that her son's now in prison for doing something very small and stupid.
Right.
Like that reaction seems overly exaggerated versus someone who's just got a 2-year sentence for being drunk and disorderly.
Yeah.
Like it's not like he killed a guy. Like it'd be that conversation. If she would have had that same reaction, if he were to have killed someone, then yes, I'd be like, oh yeah, I'd like, he was, it was just it's a misdemeanor. Like,
yeah.
like, it's like, there's a lot of heaviness and tension in that conversation, but at the same time, like that line is very dramatic for something that in 2 years.
I also like, got the impression from their conversation though, that this is the latest in a string of behavior.
Yeah. Could have. Yeah. We don't get much backstory on Cool Hand Luke.
No.
We don't even know why he did what he did. Like what happened right before him that made him want to go get drunk and be disorderly. Like
yeah.
we have no idea why he did what he did.
Yeah.
Maybe the prequel one day will tell us, Warm Hand Luke, Hot Hands Luke, Hot Hands Luke,
Hot Hands Lucas.
Maybe he's, yeah, he steals a lot. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. I just
hot red-handed.
Hot, yeah. Hey, we should write a fan fiction of
a really bad script for a
prequel to Cool Hand Luke. So yeah,
ends with him cutting the tops off of posts.
I appreciated the grittiness of their conversation.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there was some moments that was unrealistic.
Sure.
I don't think my mom, no matter what I did, would ever go to the point she's like, I wish I could forget everything else.
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, we don't know their history, but like, that specific line seemed a little bit out, but maybe it's because she knows she's on her deathbed and she's like, I want to die happy. And right now there's two bad things going on.
Sure.
And it'd just be,
we're
easy.
Not going to have a chance to reconcile our relationship right. before I die.
So like, yeah, she's also on her deathbed.
Yeah. Almost immediately after that scene, his nephew asks him why he doesn't have chains. And he says, you know, them chains ain't metals. You get them from making mistakes, and you make a bad enough mistake, and then you got to deal with the man. And he is one rough old boy. And then later, he's got two sets of chains on. And when he first gets his chains, the guy says to him, you're going to get used to wearing them chains after a while, Luke, but you never stop listening to them clinking, because they're going to remind you of what I've been saying for your own good. To which Luke says, I wish you'd stop being so good to me, Captain. And that's when he's like, he hits him hard and says, what we've got here is a failure to communicate, which is like an iconic line.
It's an iconic line, yeah.
But I
didn't know it came from this movie.
I've heard that
line before.
I did, but I didn't know the context of it.
And then there's a Reliant K song called Failure to Excommunicate.
Yes.
And so I've always, it's one of the names of their songs too. Like, so I've heard that phrase multiple times too. Mm-hmm. But I've also heard the original, and I had no idea it came from this movie.
I thought it was really interesting. Also, when I made the 2 Chainz connection, I thought maybe that the rapper 2 Chainz. No, nothing to do with Cool Hand Luke.
Are you a big 2 Chainz fan?
No, I just know that he exists.
He does exist. Yeah. By a different name for most of his life, honestly.
Yeah, and his previous name had some strong language in it, and he insists that it wasn't on, that it was unrelated.
What was his previous name?
I had looked it up. Let me check.
I only know of him. I couldn't tell you one of his songs.
He was known professionally before as Boy.
Are you serious?
TITYBOI. He claims it's because when he was a young man, he was a bit of a mama's boy, and so within his neighborhood, they called him a boy because like he's still on his mom's
teat.
Yeah,
that's horrible. Okay, can we, while we're on the subject, this is completely off topic, but like, what's the issue with rappers having these these weird names? Like, why does it happen? Because like most of these current hip hop artists, and I'm getting way off, but like they have these cheesy names, like Lil Baby, but the content that they talk about are very serious, very worldly, very heavy things,
and then you
but
add
they go
on
by
that.
Lil Baby, Snoop Dogg,
and then you add on that, it's not like their given names are so
right.
So forget. It's not like they're all named John Smith, and so to differentiate,
right?
Like they all have names like Leandre, and it's like, well, that's memorable.
And it's not even, this isn't even a criticism on their ability to rap, but like, I will say, like, I like hip hop. I like the hip hop that I listen to, at least. Like, but there's a lot of artists that I won't give them 2 cents of time because of their name.
Right.
I'm just curious of that. I was like, why do such a lame name, but then your content be so like, I don't know. Why does it work? Because people listen to them.
If 2 Chainz' name was an homage to Cool Hand Luke, honestly, it would have given me more respect for him.
But in 2 Chainz, that one's not even what I'm referring. Like, it's Lil Baby.
No, I know, but I mean, like, if the name is a reference to something with a little bit more cultural significance, right? Then it's like, okay. Yeah. A lot of times it's like, I don't know, show me that what you have to say is worth hearing because you're an intelligent person. That's what I want to know. Okay. I got 2 more things really that I want to talk about. Do you have anything else?
The prison thing was the biggest
one.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit between, if you're not a Patreon subscriber, our Paddington episode was, I don't know if I have favorites, but like, I really enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah.
Our Paddington 2 episode, if you're not a subscriber, that may be the best off 250 episode we've done so far.
I've listened to that song a couple times a day, every
that
day.
That song
since,
is
still.
Horrible.
It's a good song.
But anyway, so yeah, we talk a little bit more from a different perspective, a little bit about prison stuff too. So there's stuff there. If you haven't, please check it out. Please support us. We've hit all the big things I wanted to mention.
Okay. Here's a minor one first. You calling me a liar? No, not a liar. You just have a common and likable tendency towards exaggeration. I really like that line. I'd never heard it before, but I feel like that's a line that should be quoted more about people who, you know, tell tall tales. Yeah. So that was just a quick aside. that same Dragline, when they're getting ready to do the egg contest, the guy said, I think it was understood that he'd be peeling the eggs himself. And Dragline says, when it comes to the law, nothing is understood. What do you think that means? I think it's a brilliant and really prescient line, but what do you think it means?
Say it one more time.
When it comes to the law, nothing is understood.
Without the context of the movie and the rest of their conversation, when it comes to the law, nothing is understood. Honestly, I would lean into it heavily. It's one of the reasons why I, up until this podcast and just before you and I starting this podcast, I tried to stay apolitical and just stay out of it because like I didn't understand any of it.
Okay.
It's so like now law is obviously a little bit different than government in general, but like our essential, so essentially just our structure of governing and law and authority.
Yeah.
So they do coincide, but some of it's a little further out. There's a lot more to it than I feel should be.
Sure.
So
that's not quite the point he's making.
Right. But you just that. Okay. So what
the context was, the guy said, I thought it was understood that he'd be peeling the eggs himself. And Dragline says, when it comes to the law, nothing is understood. So if we switch the word understood for assumed, both sentences kind of maintain their meaning. So when it comes to the law, nothing is assumed. What does that mean for you?
When it comes to the law, nothing is assumed. I don't know. I kind of assume everything when it comes to the law.
Sure.
Because I assume they're going to do this. I assume outside of knowing that, yes, this is illegal. This is not.
Right.
How is it going to be handled?
Yeah.
I assume this way, like, because I can't list any policies. It's like, so, but in the eggshell situation, I mean, their assumption is, well, specifically one person's assumption is that within that 60 minutes, not only does he have to eat the eggs, he has to crack and shell them as well. Mm-hmm. And so like, that's why it added that there was an extra added level of impossibility to it.
Right.
And here all of a sudden they're like, oh, because an important factor, they've got money riding on this.
Yes. And they hadn't discussed whether eggs would be cracked and shelled.
Right.
Before.
So people are betting on this and have already betted on this. And all of a sudden there's been a change in what some people assumed was a rule.
Yeah.
And that just becomes from a lack of someone going, okay, we need to establish algorithm of what's going to happen.
Right.
No one thought to do that. Not that that's wrong.
Right.
But then when you get to the point of something happening, but you've not had the, let's have a DTR,
yep,
a define the relationship conversation about what's about to happen.
Yeah.
If you haven't had that leading up to a specific event, then yeah, there's going to be assumptions and there's going to be some missed assumptions.
That's right.
As far as the law goes, let me try to relate it back to the law here. Like, pondering on this for too long, like for me, the most, whenever I'm thinking about the law is just whether like, am I allowed to do this or am I not allowed to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And is there punishment for something if I do this specifically,
mm-hmm,
that could be, it's like, I don't know if I've put much assumption in specifically law following because like, I'm a law abiding citizen for the most part. Like there's not many times where I'm thinking about, oh, I hope I don't get caught. Like, it's like, I guess I've not really thought about in the idea of law in general.
Yeah.
But in interactions between you and me or in parenting and in being a husband, like there's a lot of times where in the law of our house,
yep,
and the rules of our established, yeah, like I make assumptions all the time in those situations, and sure, they go way wrong.
Or sometimes it's fine because the assumption is a mutually, right, held assumption.
But there's a lot of times where a DTR talk would be way beneficial and we did not have it,
sure,
leading up to an event. But specifically government, I probably not as much. Does
how
that answer
you,
your?
Yeah. Okay. How would you define law?
Law is an established. Okay. And I'm not reading this from me. This is how I would just assume.
Yeah.
Like, law is an established set of guidelines on a specific topic or event or thing.
Okay.
So guidelines on how to do or not to do something involving the thing at hand.
Okay. Yeah.
I know that's vague, but like.
Yeah, that's close.
But like.
Close to how I define
laws
it.
Are specific about something, but sometimes laws can be broad, which is where you get those gray areas,
yeah,
of should she, shouldn't she type of thing.
Yeah.
But laws, you saw that too, right?
Yeah. All right. We had a little power outage, but we're back. Jeff, do you remember what you were saying?
No, I blacked out this whole episode.
Okay. Well, I can pick up kind of where I was, the point I was making.
Yeah.
You had articulated your definition of laws. I would say that laws are agreed upon rules within a community.
Yes.
Okay. And sometimes that community is very small, where it's a relationship between two people. Sometimes it's much larger. Grand,
yeah.
And so if laws are merely the agreed upon rules, and if in law nothing is understood, nothing is assumed, what that basically means is if you and I haven't decided, and we're kind of assuming these rules between us,
yeah,
one of us is going to eventually maybe bump up against something that the other person yeah. assumed was an understood
right.
situation here.
But if that's the case, if nothing had been discussed, then no one's technically at fault.
Right.
Right? So yeah, because like in the eggshell situation, like they didn't have the conversation. So like just because people had different assumptions,
right,
there no one's at fault, because just as someone assumed this wasn't going to happen, the other person could have assumed this was going to. It's like, right. It's like there's no fault, but there is now a miscommunication and a failure to communicate.
Well, and what happens when we have that friction, laws are violated.
Yeah.
Assumed rules within a community are violated. And how do you resolve a violated law?
Boxing match.
Boxing match is one way. A much more common way is for somebody to decide, yeah. usually a third party. And when somebody makes a decision, that codifies the law, and that is what a judge does, right? So going back to our conversation about a free society, what would this look like? Well, we have a situation where two groups of people have different assumptions about how this relationship ought to work, and so a third party clarifies what would be the fair thing. I think given this egg contest, what a judge might decide is since one group had assumed the eggs would be peeled, and the other group had assumed the eggs wouldn't be peeled, let's peel half them.
50-50.
50-50.
50-50. 50 Cent. Another rapper which has a name that just...
I believe it's a reference to the time he was shot.
50 times? 50,
5 times I think he's been shot.
50 cents worth of ammunition?
I can't remember which comic it was. I think it was Dave Chappelle.
Chappelle sounds like
a show. Said... shot 5 times. Who was the assassin? Ray Charles? Get him yet, Ray? Get who? All right. So that was, when it comes to law, nothing is understood. I think that was that's a really interesting line about what is the purpose of law? What is the, who decides these things? And it's got to be a third party that has nothing, like no skin in the game.
You're saying that's the only way for it to be the best? You're saying two parties can't come up with an established set of rules together?
They absolutely can. They absolutely
okay,
can.
Okay.
But there will be times when they can't.
Okay. Gotcha.
Right?
Yeah.
And then the last thing here, when he was, so his mother dies, and the captain says, when a man's mother dies, and he gets to thinking about her funeral and paying respects, before he knows it, his mind ain't right. He's got rabbit in his blood, and he runs. We keeping you off the road for a while. I thought what they were doing in this moment was giving pretext to giving him a couple days off, but then they put him in the box. And as he's being put in the box, the guard says, sorry, Luke, I'm just doing my job. You got to appreciate that. And Luke says, nah, calling it your job don't make it right, boss.
Mm.
And what's that? We've talked about this before.
Stockholm Center.
Nuremberg defense.
Nuremberg and Churgen.
And I just thought that was a really interesting.
Like, but in this scenario, like, see, like, he broke an established, like,
he hadn't.
Okay, why was he in the box for this time?
He's why, in the
this,
box.
This specific the one, why was he going in the box?
Because his mother died. He hasn't broken any rules yet.
They just put him in the box because his mom died.
Because they were afraid that he was going to try to run.
Oh, well then, that whole conversation is, yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And in fact, I think it was putting him in the box that broke him.
To run.
Because up until this point, he had complied with the rules.
Yeah.
He'd been an excellent prisoner. In fact, we had just had the, he wants speed, let's give him speed. Right?
Right. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. It's.
He'd brought camaraderie. Yeah, that's
a weird decision.
Yeah. I thought they were giving pretext to giving him some days to grieve. And I was like, wow, that's really beautiful. And then it's like, oh no, they're not.
They're, yeah.
They're going to punish him for his mother dying.
Yeah. A man can play a mean banjo.
Yeah. All right. Wrap up?
Wrap up. Would you recommend this film?
I would.
I would too. It was good. It was good.
If for some reason you've listened to this and not seen Cool Hand Luke, go watch Cool Hand Luke.
You just recommended it.
Yeah.
No, yeah, it is a good film. It's it's rated GP. Yeah. Did you change the rating?
No, I think this is suitable for general public.
There's a couple moments
that you thought were unsuitable for general public?
It's definitely not G. Honestly, I would lean towards PG-13 for a couple moments.
Okay.
The language isn't crazy.
No. There's the woman.
There's the woman being very erotic. There's no nudity, but like heavy cleavage, very sexual in her body language.
Yeah.
And guys very lustfully looking at her. And
boy, were they.
Yeah. It's like that moment's not great for PG.
No.
Now that could easily be trimmed for TV because it wasn't very vital to the whole film. But
I think it was a good insight into one of the struggles that men face when in prison.
Right. but then on top of that, there is forms of what you and I would probably call torture in this film.
Yeah.
And that's also not great for PG.
No.
So I would lean towards PG-13.
Okay.
Could it be made PG or TV friendly? Yeah, very quickly. But this isn't a movie a 5 or 6 year old could easily just watch and go or understand and comprehend.
Sure.
So I would rate it as PG-13.
Okay.
Would you still do PG?
I think PG-13 makes sense for this.
Okay. Has it aged well? 1967.
I think it's aged very well.
I really liked the tone and the vibe of this film. Lots of blue. The blue skies in this movie were beautiful. Like I appreciated that. Would this be in your personal top 250?
I think I gave it 4 stars.
4 out of 5. Okay.
And so I think that's going to end up being in my top 250.
Okay. I gave it a 7. I gave it right there for me right there. And it's just that I understand why people like this. It's not a movie I'm going to be running back to watch anytime soon.
Okay.
But I do appreciate it. And I probably will watch it again eventually, down the road. Probably not till after we're done with this podcast. I probably won't repeat any movies while we're watching movies this frequent. But yeah, I'd watch this again. It'll most likely probably shake out in my top 250.
Yeah.
Why do you think this is on the top 250? Barely. It's 244.
Yeah.
Why do you think this is and has been since the creation of the IMDb top 250? Why do you think this is on the top 250?
I think because we don't know why anybody's in prison except for Luke.
Right.
And we know that the reason that he's in prison is entirely, I wouldn't say entirely justified, quote unquote, because 2 years seems like a lot for this.
Yeah.
But
it could have just been
a legitimate.
They could have fined him.
Yeah. Like a legitimate.
He didn't even take the heads of the, he didn't even steal any money.
Well, I think
he just defaced them.
I think it's safe to assume
he was going to, yeah.
But we know, he actually did do wrong, right?
Yeah, correct.
So I would say that a major aspect of this is that it humanizes prisoners and it called into question, how should prisoners be treated? What's justified? What rights do prisoners have, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a big aspect here.
I think for me, and this may go in a little bit of what you said, but it's a story of just life happening. There's not a huge villain in this movie. There's not this huge accomplishable goal that you're watching play out. You're just watching a guy in prison while life happens around him, react.
Yeah.
And that's not something you see in a lot of films.
Yeah.
Of just this moment of watching this guy live life in this certain amount of time. It does happen before. In other films. But I think there's that. And I think the fact that you can see, and we don't know for sure, but there's moments in this movie that you can definitely feel could have been the inspiration for other moments in other films.
Yeah.
And it's and for legitimate reasons. And it's so there's a lot of moments in this movie you're going, oh, well, that feels familiar. That feels like this may have been the first of something else I've viewed later on.
Sure.
And it's there's a lot of times in this where I had that experience. And we've talked about this film before. We've not talked about it yet. This would be an off 250 movie, I believe, is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Mm-hmm.
There was a bunch of moments in this movie that was like the chain gang type stuff.
Sure.
Like I was like, oh, I've seen this before. No, I'm curious if there was any crossover there from writing and pulling from just how they depicted stuff and stuff. So I think this movie definitely established a lot of groundwork and framing for how prison is depicted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily know how in 2024, what makes it still relevant. Cause I think there's modern movies that are doing.
And prison looks so different.
Right. So like, so if you're doing a period piece of prison, I think this could be helpful, but like, I can see why it's at the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
The acting's not the best, but it's not the worst. Like the acting's good.
Paul Newman's acting was terrific.
It was great. Very stoic. We didn't even. I think it's the first time we've mentioned the word stoic all film. But like, yeah. It's a very stoic character. Like very like just and like that way was done well. But like maybe not done the best, but done very well. Like
yeah.
His acting's great. The warden. I don't know. The warden was kind of weird as far as the acting goes. Like
yeah.
His voice bothered me. It's like
it felt a bit like a caricature of yeah. A plantation owner.
So like just yeah, just there was moments where I'm like, okay, I've seen this done better. It's like. I can understand why at one point this was on the top 250. For it to still be on now, the bottom of the pack makes sense. I liked it.
I liked it more than off.
Okay.
I think it's a movie that if it's not on the top 250, a lot of people will pass. You know, I think there's something about being on the IMDb top 250 that helps a movie be seen by people that otherwise might skip it, just especially when they're older movies. So I don't want to see this one fall off, but I understand why it is where it is.
All right. Well, that's all I had, my friend.
What do we have next week?
Next week we have Reservoir Dogs
with returning guest, our sugar daddy,
our producer,
Tim,
quote unquote, unquote,
unquote, unquote,
Tim Durfler.
Yeah.
Reservoir Dogs. Quentin Tarantino.
Is this our first Tarantino? Might be.
It could be. There's no way of knowing. I've not seen this movie. Have you seen this film?
I started it once.
Okay. I feel like I've started it once too. 1992, big hitting cast. Tim Roth, Steve Buscemi, Quentin Tarantino. I guess it's not as big as I thought it was, actually.
It's a big cast.
But all I recognize is Quentin Tarantino and Tim Roth sounds familiar.
Yeah,
and Steve Buscemi.
Tim Roth. Who am I missing? You'll recognize
Samuel Jackson in this.
I don't know. Tim Roth was Abomination in Incredible Hulk.
Ah, yes, he's also in Holes.
Okay, so this will be our first Tarantino, but we're doing another Tarantino in 2 weeks.
Yes, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
So we've got Reservoir Dogs coming up with Tim, and then we're going to be doing Django Unchained with Isaiah in the future.
Okay, yeah. Samuel Jackson is not...
Not in this one? Sir, not,
he's not at the top.
This film.
Yeah, no, I don't... This cast is not as big as I thought it was. But I don't recognize most of these actors. Well, thank you. This was a great conversation.
Yeah.
This was a fun movie. This is one... This, you know how I've said in previous episodes where like I want to have those movies in my back pocket... That are older that I can say I've seen and I've enjoyed.
Yeah.
This is going in my back pocket.
Yeah.
Again, not my favorite of all time.
Sure.
But just like, oh yeah, I've seen a movie. I've seen an older movie.
I've seen Cool
Aunt Yeah,
Luke.
Cool Aunt Luke, absolutely. It's like
you haven't seen Cool Aunt Luke?
So this is one of my back pocket movies for me.
Pack pocket.
Yep.
All right.
But well, I love you.
And see you in a week.
Bye. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did.
If you have found value in what we discussed today, please consider leaving us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.
If you have any feedback or suggestions, we would love to hear from you.
That's right. Tell us why we're wrong.
If you want even more content and ways to engage with us and each other, check out our Patreon page.
By supporting us there, you'll get access to exclusive bonus content and help us continue to create high quality episodes, as well as help pay for our future plans. Links to our social media, merchandise, and Patreon are in the show notes.